Hello and welcome to another catch-up episode. How are you? Now, if it's the first time you've listened to a catch-up episode, I generally ask that, and then, you know, you're on your own, you're just in your studio, no one can listen, so just, you know, one word, how's it going? Ready? I'm going to ask you again, all right? How are you? Ooh, okay. Different, interesting. Well, we're in different and interesting times, aren't we? How'd the holidays go? Did they go well? Me? Oh, fine, thank you. Thanks for asking. I had a strange thing happen over the holidays. I was all going full steam ahead with my daily meditations and podcast editing and all this. Well, not a huge amount of editing anymore, but still podcast organizing and all the other things that I'm doing. And then got to the Friday before Christmas, and I just finished a Zoom group. I do this Further Emergent Zoom groups every week. And the next day I was ready to sort of do the meditation and continue on. And when I was meditating myself, I just got this thing of like, no, that's it now. You're on holidays. Nothing for 2 weeks. And it was the strangest experience because there had been so much momentum to what I was doing. And I've been going pretty much since the beginning of the lockdown. I've been like, my workload had kind of doubled almost. Yeah, to just stop for 2 weeks was very interesting, to just be idle. I remember I read a book called How to Be Free. Let me just find out who the name of the author is. Tom Hodgkinson. How to Be Free by Tom Hodgkinson. I read it years ago, and he was outlining the benefits of being idle. And quite a confronting read, a lovely read, very gentle, but just talking about being idle and how beneficial it is on so many different levels. So I got to experience that for 2 weeks, being idle. It was quite interesting. I was quite used to it by the end. Speaking of books, I read a very good book. I had actually finished it before the holidays started. And when I say read, I mean listened to. It's called Breath. And it's by James Nestor. And it's just a very deep dive into breathing and the benefits of breathing, really, breathing correctly. I can give you a couple of the takeaways. I mean, he goes right into it, and it's a fascinating listen or read. But basically, mouth breathing is really bad for you. So breathing with your mouth open doesn't matter whether you're exercising, doesn't matter what you're doing, breathing through your mouth is not good. So, and I must say, I generally am not a mouth breather anyway, but since reading it, I've been more conscious of breathing through my mouth or not breathing through my mouth. And yeah, it's surprising how, you know, if once you become conscious of it, you can do it. Now, he does talk a lot about mouth breathing at night, like mouth breathing when you're asleep, and how difficult, how bad that is for your body. And, you know, he goes right into the science of it, and he has all himself measured up and all sorts of things. But he talks about different ways that you can train your mouth to stay closed while you're asleep, and how that can, you know, substantially improve your health, overall health. Yeah, he did an experiment where he breathed only through his mouth for 10 days, himself and another guy, under supervision through some university that I can't remember the name of right now. It was a proper study. And then another 10 days just breathing through his nose, and the differences in all his blood work and cardiac function, all over, immune function, everything just substantially improved. So, yeah. If you don't want to read the book, just start breathing through your mouth. Start breathing through your nose. Brilliant advice here. Always very on the spot. Yeah, breathing through your nose. Huge. And I went for a pretty substantial walk there about a week ago, up over the mountains. It's on I put it on one of the social channels, some video I took of it. So, but pretty intense kind of uphill. And I was very conscious of the breathing through my nose thing. And it's quite possible to do it. to just keep breathing through the nose and not sort of gasping through the mouth. And yeah, it was fine. So yeah, breathe through your nose, very, very beneficial. And that's it's a good read. If you've got a couple of credits on Audible, yeah, definitely recommend it. Breathe, James Nestor. Speaking of beautiful books, I finally got the cover that my daughter designed up on my book, Why Do We Get Sick? Why Do We Get Better? It's the sort of 2021 edition of it. I wrote it in 2006, but I sort of spent a bit of time last year updating it. Not a huge amount of changes, but, you know, just updating a few things that had changed. And I got my daughter Yasmin to design the cover with me. And yeah, I think she did a great job. And finally got it up, got the new cover on the book. So yeah, if you want to go and have a look at that. It's not an audiobook yet. Still in the process of doing the audiobook for my other book, May Annoys. But the Why Do We Get Sick? Why Do We Get Better book will be the next one. And it's funny, it's quite a prescient. Is that the right word? Let me go and look for a prescient. Yeah, so that is how you pronounce prescient, but it's completely using it in the wrong context. There you go. You learn something new every day. I just learned what prescient actually means. It means like having presence or knowledge of things or events before they exist or happen. Having foresight, which isn't what I meant at all. I meant it's pertinent. My book about Why Do We Get Sick and Why Do We Get Better. Because of everything that's going on. We're in a pandemic. How did you know that? We're in a pandemic at the moment, if you hadn't noticed. And yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, it's funny, like I come at all of this kind of stuff from a very, you know, I've been involved in health for, you know, years. I mean, it's the thing that I've been involved in most really in my life, even though I've had lots of different careers and not lots of different careers, but you know, I wasn't film and TV before that, but you know, I spent most of my working life as a therapist, and specifically a craniosacral therapist, which is under the umbrella of the natural therapies, which when I started was you know, one step away from voodoo. It certainly wasn't acknowledged in any way, shape or form. Now, a little bit better, a little bit more, but my approach to health has always been from that kind of natural perspective. And then from working with lots of people over the years, sort of seeing how fantastic our bodies are at healing themselves and fixing themselves. And that was the impetus behind, if you can, I'll just say, if you can hear a lot of noise in the background, yeah, we're in like full lockdown here in Ireland again. And so my wife is home and is charging around in the background doing stuff. But, you know, it's never quiet here. So I just have to go ahead and record. So apologies if you can hear a lot of noise in the background. So, yeah, my approach has always, you know, my focus has always been on that your body is designed to fix itself, and if you give it the right support, it'll do that. And of course, because that's my the way I see things, I'm going to get confirmation of that, you know, confirmation bias in full swing. So it's funny, like when this whole pandemic thing started and people were, you know, very concerned and nervous about the virus, and you know, I was, you know, looking into it and going, okay, well, I know a bit about viruses, and I know, yeah, it can be pretty intense. And if this one is like SARS or MERS, yeah, well, I can understand the concern. But then, you know, as time went on, I could kind of, you know, these lockdowns and the face masks and all this kind of thing. And just the scale of it, the scale of the people's, you know, this is a worldwide thing. Well, it's a pandemic, isn't it? I looked into it more and more, and I learned more and more. And the more I learned, the more I was, I don't know what the word is, dismayed. Yeah, let's say dismayed. That what had happened, you know, what was happening for me in my life all through my, you know, time working as a natural therapist, was seemed to be happening on a much bigger scale, because beforehand, you know, you'd meet somebody at a social gathering of some kind or another, and they'd say, what do you do? And you'd say, I'm a craniosacral therapist. And they'd either go, well, that's really interesting, or their eyes would glaze over. And, you know, that was fine. And people would sort of go, oh, I've got a bit of a sniffle, I'm going off to the doctor to get an antibiotic. And, you know, I personally would know, well, that's a terrible thing to do for your immune system, you know, because if you keep taking antibiotics, it's just going to deplete your immune system. You know, they're not meant to be taken for every single little thing. But then I also know that most doctors are generally overworked and underpaid. Certainly, I don't know how it is in America, but certainly in Australia and Ireland. And I think in the UK as well. And so they just, you know, they have a huge amount of people that they have to see. And it's just easier to, you know, if somebody is saying, I want an antibiotic, I'm not going to get better unless I have an antibiotic. It's just easier to give it to them, you know. So I understand that. And I understand that, you know, people, you know, they can have whatever they want. You know, that's fine. It wouldn't be what I'd do. And God, I can't remember the last time I had an antibiotic. I mean, it'd be decades now at this stage. So normally, or previously to the pandemic, it was kind of like, well, that's people's choices. And, you know, I have a particular perspective and something that I'm interested in. And I've got a lot of reference for if you relate to your body like a machine, then, and you go to the doctor and relate to the doctor like a mechanic, and you're like, just, you know, fix me, doc. I've got nothing to do with this. I can eat rubbish, I can not exercise, and I can not take care of myself, and you just have to fix me. Well, that's one way of going about it. And then, or you can, you know, take responsibility for your health and kind of educate yourself about the different things and find ways to, you know, and not relate to your body as a machine, but more as an expression of, you know, who you are, and that you're a custodian of it, and that it has an inherent ability to fix itself if you're given enough time and support. You know, so I was like happy enough going along with that. It's like, oh, well, I have the way I go about things, and other people have, you know, they've got their way of going about things, and that's fine. But what the pandemic has kind of, what's happened is, it's like, wow, so many people are really suffering because of their perspective, it seems to me. You know, like I had encounters with doctors throughout the years, and some doctors are brilliant. They're just fantastic and inspiring. And then other doctors are just really arrogant and very much like, you know, encouraging people to look, you know, not to be responsible for their health at all. And just look, we're the doctor, we're the expert. You just shut up and do what you're told. Take the pill or whatever, you know. And again, my perspective are just informed by my experience and what I've, you know, encountered with treating people, a lot of people. So, one kind of aspect that has, you know, come across quite strongly is about symptom suppression. And like, if you relate to your body as a machine, then you don't want any kind of symptoms at all. You know, you just want, no, I don't want any discomfort. I don't, you know, I just want all that to stop. Like one great example, or a really clear example of it is, you know, I'd often see kids who had, they might have eczema, and they'd go to the doctor, and the doctor would prescribe steroid cream, and the eczema would clear up, and it'd be great. And then 6 months later, the child would develop asthma. And like, that's a really good example of when you suppress symptoms one place, they just come out somewhere else, because the lining of your lungs is kind of like your inside skin. So the doctor would be like treating the asthma as a completely new thing. Whereas from my perspective, it'd be like, well, that's just the eczema. It's just gone inside, pretty much. You've just forced it inside with the steroids. And it's not like I would advocate, oh, you should, you know, if you've got a headache, don't take any painkillers or anything like that. But it's like if you suppress symptoms and you know that you're suppressing them, if you're consciously doing it, then you're still looking for the root cause, because any kind of symptom is generally an expression of your body trying to do something. Like, and I talk about this in my book, actually, the Why Do We Get Sick book, you know, the difference between, you know, somebody who you come across somebody and they're sitting on a park bench and they've got a business suit on, but they're sweating and their heart is racing and they're out of breath. They're having trouble breathing. You'd kind of think, oh my God, this person's having a heart attack. And then when you say, are you okay? And they go, yeah, I just ran in. I just sprinted in here and sat down. I'm just having a rest. You know, then you go, oh, okay, that's fine. Because you're kind of going, oh, okay, that's not something wrong. That's just a response to them sprinting into the park to sit on a bench, which is a strange thing to do. But it's this thing of like, oh, those aren't symptoms. That's not a problem. So they're not symptoms. But if somebody, say, has a high temperature, oh, that is a symptom and that is a problem. But to me, like, there's no difference. It's like the high temperature is generally an indication of your body is trying to fight off something. It's trying to kill off something by raising the temperature of your body to kill off an infection or a bacteria or something that it's not happy with or has disturbed the balance, the homeostasis in your body. But what all the focus on COVID is very much about symptom suppression, as far as I can see. And this idea of, you know, viruses are bad, which, like when you look into viruses, or when I looked into viruses in more depth, that viruses have been around for a long, long time, like millions of years. And in many ways, they've helped us adapt, because how viruses happen is, you know, you have a bunch of cells doing a thing in the swamp, the primordial swamp, and maybe the swamp heats up, or maybe it cools down, or something happens to change the normal everyday of those cells. And the cells, you could say that a stress is put on those cells, and then in response to that stress, then the cells adapt. And how they adapt is through, like, the product of that adaptation is a virus, which is like the carrier for the latest upgrade in the software of the cell, and it goes to all the other cells, and then they all have the new adaptation. Like, that's the function of viruses. You know, that's the difference between a bacteria and a virus. A virus isn't a living thing; it's just a container, really. Whereas a bacteria is a living thing. And bacteria and viruses often get lumped in together, but they're quite different. And again, going back to antibiotics, like, people would often kind of go, "Oh, I've got a virus. I'm going to the doctor to get an antibiotic." And I'd be kind of thinking, that's a strange thing to do, because viruses, you know, they don't respond to antibiotics, because antibiotics are antibiotic. They're against bacteria. They work for bacteria for sure, but they don't work for viruses. So if you go and have an antibiotic when you've got a virus, all you do is deplete your immune system, and you won't get rid of you won't deal with the virus. So this idea that viruses are bad, like some of the, like, for example, one of the adaptations we made as we were developing as humans, evolving as humans, is we figured out how to make a placenta in reproduction. You know, placenta is part of, you know, it's almost like the interface between the baby in the womb and the mother's body. You know, it's a fantastic thing, the placenta. It's amazing structure. But the creation of placenta happened as a result of a mutation, and it was made and passed on by a virus. Like the pre-placenta, there's the organisms were trying to create, it wasn't working, and then, you know, with stress, something happened, one bit of DNA was written in a different way, and that, you know, was created. We figured out a new way to do, but the information that carried that on was part of a virus, and then that virus was transmitted to all the other mammals, and suddenly everybody could have a placenta, and it was like, great. Like, that's as a result of a virus. And like, our bodies, we've got loads of viruses in our bodies all the time, you know, like, I don't know what number there are, but I'm not good with numbers and facts. I'm good at the result, you know, like, if you tell me a story about something, I won't remember the story so much, but I'll remember the end result or the but this is all checkable. You can check all this up. This isn't, you know, it's not just an idea I have. It's all verifiable, you know. There's quite a lot of our own evolution is down to viruses. So viruses are kind of like the updaters. And they're airborne. You know, they're carried in the air, and they go up into the air. Like, you see the maps of, here's how the spread of the virus, and it was all to do with air travel. That's not how viruses travel at all. They travel in the air. And, you know, once a virus happens, it is pretty much around the planet very quickly, like within a matter of weeks. And it's nothing to do with air travel. It's to do with it's in the air, you know. So I'm kind of watching that and going, okay, that's very, going after one virus is very symptom suppressy. And that's not to say that, I'm not saying it doesn't exist at all. Of course it exists, but there's loads of viruses in your body. Like, I can't remember the number, but it's a huge percentage. Like, when you add up all the viruses and all the bacteria that live in us, you know, we're over 50% of us is all that stuff, you know. There was quite a famous book many years ago when I was studying. It was called Life on Man. And it was, you know, this microphotography of all these different microorganisms that live in us and on us. I mean, it's kind of creepy. It could give you the heebie-jeebies. And I didn't like looking at that book for for long. But it just kind of shows how, you know, most of our body is not us. It's, you know, we're in communion with other creatures. And one of the things I like to think about is fiber. You know, the way, you know, people go, oh, you might need a bit of fiber in your diet. You know, and if you've ever ate fiber, you know, very fiber rich kind of food, it's like, well, how could this be good for me? It tastes like I'm eating roof tiles or whatever. But one way to think about it is, in your intestines, the fiber is like, acts like coral, you know, the reef that the coral grows on. And without it, it doesn't have anything to grow on. And, you know, we kind of, all the bacteria in our intestines, that does the digesting for us. So we're living in harmony with them, with our, it's called our microbiome. It's kind of a buzzword at the moment. But our intestines, like, we kind of send down the food, and then the bacteria digest it for us, and we get the benefit of the results of that. So it's a lovely kind of harmonious relationship. But what is surprising is when you start to overlay different maps on top of seemingly unrelated maps, because when you understand that viruses, new viruses come as a result of stressors and as a result of evolution, then you can kind of go, okay, well, where, you know, this particular one, this COVID-19 one, it goes on, it has a reaction in the lungs, but, you know, there's this thing like, if your lungs are strong and healthy, it's not, you're going to be asymptomatic, you're not going to have any symptoms. And the picture of the number of cases and where it started and all that kind of thing, when you start to overlay other maps on top of that, you sort of go, oh, okay, so there's a deeper thing going on here. Because if the viruses are traveling, if COVID has gone all over the world, then why is it, you know, like in Ireland, we were very shocked by what happened in Italy. In Northern Italy, oh my God, you know, we don't want that to happen here. And that was the impetus for our first lockdown was to try and avoid that. But when you overlay the on top of the COVID cases, when you overlay the use of pesticide, they're practically a match, you know, like the strongest concentration of use of pesticide, and in particular glyphosate, which is the main kind of component in Roundup. When you overlay that on, or the highest concentration of the use of that is in Wuhan, where COVID started. So you start to kind of see, oh, this is deeper than just a virus. I mean, the virus is everywhere, but it's only affecting people in certain areas most strongly, you know. And that's kind of disturbing, because if you kind of focus on, oh, we must beat this virus, it's like, well, there's going to be another one. There's going to be another one, because this is just a natural expression of stresses that we're putting on just the whole on nature. It's just what nature's been doing for millions of years. But, you know, we think we're very clever and that we can muscle it into place. You know, it's like when people talk about, oh, you know, climate change and we have to, you know, save the planet, you know. I always think that's really funny, because, you know, the planet doesn't need saving. Like, we need saving, for sure. But the planet will just, you know, sneeze us off the planet if we become too annoying. And it will repair itself very quickly. Like, as soon as, well, you could see it in the first lockdown, you know. Blue skies over Beijing, clear sea, the sea started to clear up, river started to clear up. When everything stopped, you know, I mean, it's gone back now, worse than ever, but it's a very clear indication. And all the pictures of animals coming, roaming through the cities that were on lockdown, which were quite lovely. And again, I think there's been projections for how quickly nature would reclaim our cities. It's surprisingly quick, you know. So yeah, like the climate change, you know, it's I think it's a real indication of monumental arrogance on our part, that we're like, oh, we don't care, like, we'll just keep going, and, you know, that it's not going to affect us. Of course it's going to affect us. Like, the planet will be fine. The planet will, nature will just do its thing, but we'll be the ones who'll be gone, you know. And one of the, like, it goes, you know, as I say, rather than the focus being on the virus, it goes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, and it goes down to one of the most boring things. It goes down to soil. Right, so I'm from urban Dublin, okay, and I'm the furthest in. Soil is like the most boring thing, I think, growing up. It was like, we would call it muck. And, like, you know, I never even thought about it, you know, earthworms and what's going on. I had no education about it, you know. But unfortunately, that's where it's at now. That's where it's happening. Is like, glyphosate has been used so much that it's causing mutations. And you get a combination of, like, factory farming. Like, the other concentration in Wuhan is of pigs, swine farming. And it's a huge concentration of that in Wuhan. So you get those two things together, a lot of Roundup, a lot of pigs, because the way pigs are farmed, and the food that they're fed is packed with antibiotics, okay, and that, unfortunately, there's antibiotics in the food they're kind of eating, that's putting a big stress on nature. And of course, nature is just going to do what nature does. It kind of adapts. It's going to start, you know, popping out new viruses. And the waste product, let's call it that, because I don't want to keep saying pig shit, but basically that's what it is. The waste products of those huge swine farms, they can't destroy it. It's practically indestructible. So they have these big lakes of it, okay, which is, and it's a biohazard pretty much. And in that big pool is all sorts of mutations are going on. I mean, it's similar in the States. Like, they know about this in America, because apparently it's illegal to transport pig shit across state lines because it's a biohazard. So they know about this, you know. And similarly, you can see the same thing in America with, you could see it with cancer. If you like, if you put a cancer map over the use of Roundup, glyphosate in farming, on, one on top of the other, and then put the water courses on top of that, you see that it pretty much follows the water course of the Mississippi River. Because all the Roundup is going off the soil into the river, and then the river is washing down into the Mississippi. And so I think it's the last 90 miles of the Mississippi River is the highest concentration of cancers. And then there's a dead zone in the Mississippi Delta. I think it's a huge, it's like the size of New Jersey or something like that. It's huge because of all this stuff that's gone into the river. And you know, most of the COVID stuff is happening in cities. Most of the really bad outbreaks are happening in cities. And it's again, like, and it was the same in Northern Italy, huge amount of pesticide an aging population. So, you know, it's that thing of like viruses don't affect healthy people. They affect people whose underlying health has been eroded. And unfortunately, that's where the focus needs to be, is on understanding like how our food and our food production has eroded us, and how, you know, pollutants in the air, like that's one of the things, like one of the ways that the virus travels is that it bonds very neatly with a byproduct of emissions, you know, carbon. I can't remember the name of the carbon, but it bonds with one of the carbons. So the fact that there's a lot of pollution in the air makes it easier for the virus to travel. So, you know, I find all that kind of like that there's a bigger problem that needs to be addressed that is being completely not looked at because of all the focus on, you know, a virus and a vaccine. And like the whole vaccine thing is like, well, I said it in one of my Zoom groups, like, you know, somebody asked me about vaccines and should I take it or whatever. And I'm like, whether you take it or not, it's completely up to yourself. But the thing that always comes back to me with vaccines and pharmaceuticals just generally, and again, this comes from, you know, bumping into it many times over the years, is that it's, you know, if you just have to keep going back to the, it's like a gangster movie or a, you know, one of those criminal movies where they're trying to, you know, bust Al Capone or whatever, and it's like, follow the money. It becomes very clear then, you know, like if all big pharmaceutical companies were not for profits, if there was no shareholders and there was no profit motivation, would we be talking about vaccines? I don't think so. not in the way that we're talking about. They'd be talking about things like, you know, establishing health, you know, fundamental health, better food production, better, you know, information about health and how your body works, and sort of strengthening your immune system rather than huge government contracts for vaccines. But again, this is all just, you know, what I, as I've observed it, you know. So yeah, if any of that stuff is interesting to you, there's a lot of different people saying it in different ways. Probably the most condensed and the most useful and the most factful would be Dr. Zach Bush. I find him very good. He's one of those, like, I'm terrible for facts and figures. He's just got one of those brains that holds it in. I'm sure he knows the miles per gallon his car is getting it. He's one of the ones I can never remember. It just doesn't stay in my brain. But no, he's, he's pretty amazing. He's on all aspects, like he's a triple board certified doctor, which means he's kind of like a doctor three times. He's in three different disciplines and has, you know, worked with lots of people. But similarly, he's kind of got to this thing of, you know, it's, I can just treat one cancer patient at a time, or I can try and get into the root cause of it. And he's got into, what's it called, Farmer's Footprint, which is an amazing story, actually. Because he talks about, he's trying to help farmers get off the chemicals, basically, because, you know, I've heard him talking about this. He's describing farmers before, or your average kind of farmer. I mean, I don't know about farmers. I come from a city. Like, I live in the country, but I don't know about farmers. I pass them, get stuck behind them in tractors, in their tractors. But I don't know what they do or what's going on for them. But anyway, he was describing how your average farmer, you know, your average family farm, 300 acres, they get about $40 an acre a year out of it, if they're lucky. And they are very stressed. Apparently, very high suicide rate among farmers, because they have to borrow money to buy seed. And then each year, because they have to use all the chemicals, the land is denatured more and more and more. So they're getting, the yields are getting less and less. And their kids look at them working their guts out and go, well, I'm not gonna do that, and there's no money in it. So the kids leave the farm and they're just stressed, and they have to work so hard. You know, they get up at 4 a.m. and work, and then they go asleep, you know, fretful. So this farmer's footprint thing that he's set up is a not-for-profit that helps them transition into, away from the chemicals and into regenerative farming, that's a hard word to say. And that takes about 3 years. So they basically need enough money to get over the hump. And that's what this farmer's footprint thing does, is it helps them with education and finance. And he was saying it's amazing the difference, like how quickly, number one, the land comes back, how quickly they can turn it around. And when they get past the 3 years, they, you know, an acre that was producing $40 now produces $800 yield, which is incredible. But what he was saying was just the difference in their, you know, their outlook. They just sort of intuitively, they just knew that all the chemicals were not, not good. You know, I suppose you can't walk the land and work with nature and not get a bit of a sense of what's, what it needs. But yeah, with these regenerative farming practices, you know, the kids are seeing that there's a future for them in it, and they're able to go back to the land, and it's just a beautiful story. So yeah, Dr. Zach Bush, MD, I think that's his website. I'll put a link in the show notes. But yeah, he's got a lot of very good videos. He's got one about the virome, which is the name for all the viruses and how fantastic they are, and he's got all these great facts and figures that he can just pop off the top of his head. I can't remember any of them, but I remember the story of them. So yeah, I don't want to bring you down or anything about it, but it's just my, what I've observed, what I've learned over the years, and then sort of seeing it playing out, and it's like, oh, okay, so it's become a bigger thing. It's become more than just well, that's just your perspective, John, and you're welcome to it. It's like it's kind of a worldwide thing that's happening at the moment of wrong focus, as far as I can see, and how that wrong focus is causing a lot of suffering. Because, you know, everything, like, okay, whether you take vaccines or not, like the vaccine for the COVID or not, like, and there's going to be another one. And then another one. If there is no change to the fundamental, the underlying thing, there can't not be another one, you know? So the more you can do to inform yourself and find out about it. As I say, all the stuff I've just said is all, you can check it all. It's all fact-based. And there's even things like what I was saying about breathing, you know, stuff like that, that all helps your immune system. There's so much you can do for your immune system to help you so that you can be one of the people who are asymptomatic for COVID and for whatever the next one is. Because that's the thing that I didn't see very little of. It's like COVID-19. You know, that's not a random name. That's because that's the 19th COVID. So there were, not, you know, 18 before this one. And it sort of naturally follows. There's going to be 20, 21, and then there'll be a new, you know, different name of it. So, yeah, as I say, these are just things that have been on my mind, particularly over the holidays. I've had more time to get into it. And, yeah, just passing it on. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, God, I'm really enjoying this podcast. I've listened to a few now and they're brilliant. And there's so many of them. And I've learned so much from listening to them. And you know what? If I met that John Dalton fella in real life, I'd love to buy him a cup of tea and have a chat with him. I'd love to do that every month if I could. Well, now you can. The tea part at least, because this podcast runs on cups of tea bought for me by people like you who listen to the podcast and send me the price of a cup of tea once a month through the Patreon account. That's patreon.com/John Dalton, gently does it, all one word. And if you're one of those people who already send me cups of tea through Patreon, thanks a million. The tea is lovely and I really appreciate it. Now, the great thing is that if you can't afford to send me the price of a cup of tea or you don't want to, that's fine. You still get exactly the same podcast for free. It's sort of an honor system where the people who can afford it and want to pay for the people who can't or don't want to. So it's all lovely. So if you'd like to send me a cup of tea once a month, you can do that through Patreon. I'd really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference to me.
It's been a slow start to the year with artists for the podcast. I've been in touch with quite a few and there's quite lots of different reasons why people can't, you know, just now. And yeah, it hasn't really got going yet. But I came across a lovely article by Julian Davis, who was a former podcast guest. I'll put a link to his episode in the show notes. But it was a lovely read because, you know, with everything that's happening and as these sort of lockdowns can go on, it seems to be getting harder and harder for artists. Or that's the way it appears, certainly depending on which, you know, bit of the art news you're reading. But yeah, Julian's article was a lovely, not antidote, but yeah, I suppose antidote or a different perspective on all that. So I'm going to finish off by reading that to you because it's a short little article and I think it's a nice read. So it's on Medium. I'll put a link to it. And it's called The Art Gallery After COVID. And the subheading is What Makes a Great Art Dealer? 2020 was surprising in many ways. In my own circle of artists and gallery owners, we feared the worst as the spring began. Surely something as inessential as art would suffer in the face of a pandemic. Yet, instead, as the year wore on, it appears the public looked around the confines of their homes and decided that art mattered. Of course, not all artists in galleries went unscathed, but some did, and it interests me to see what works sold and to ask why. I've even heard recently of new galleries opening during the pandemic. I hope they learn from the successes and failures of last year and the reminders those gave of both the role and qualities of the best art dealer. I've been in the art business for over 30 years, mostly as a painter, but briefly as a gallery owner. As an artist, I've shown with three galleries whose owners ended up in court, but with more than a dozen with whom it has been a joy to work. On the other side of the business, I've also known the intense pleasure of calling up an artist to tell them of a sale and a favourite piece having found a worthy home. Seeing the art market from both sides, I've often reflected on the necessary attributes of the art dealer. What are they? The hunter-gatherer. Gallerists need to be art collectors themselves. In fact, many great art dealers are close to being hoarders. Dealer Alan Stone described himself as an addict, in inverted commas. They need to be kindred spirits to the collectors they inspire and create. The best art dealer is a hunter and gatherer of art, a collection he or she has picked by hand and would store, if they could, room after room for their own delight. The clear enthusiasm of their magpie nature is how they sell art. The curator. A gallery owner needs to be an arbiter of taste. This is more crucial than ever before. It relates directly to how galleries have survived this year and will survive the future. The internet has created a babel of art that confound the public. A gallery needs to provide moments of quiet and clarity. Reflecting its owner's tastes and preferences, a gallery should not try to have something for everyone. Their stable of artists should be chosen slowly and patiently, much as a collector should be advised to build their collection. This distinct bias towards art that has both depth and relation to the world we live in, rather than just being decor, is something that galleries forgot during the art boom that began in the late 1980s. They forgot or never learned that discrimination defines the identity of the gallery. Before galleries tried to please everyone, they were the original curated retailing, the original influencers. The dealer curated their client's collection. He or she influenced the public response to art. The socialite. The gallerist needs to be a natural host. They should love parties and society, and think of their gallery as a salon of their own creation. Following the salon tradition of the 18th century, their aim should be to bring together every kind of art enthusiast to the benefit of all. The champion. They need to be a voice. Artists all agree that their profession is too hard and uncertain not to be treated as a vocation. An art dealer would be well advised to do the same. Owning an art gallery is too difficult to be pursued for mere profit. A gallerist has the chance to champion artists and promote art in their community. In Isaac Dinesen's Babette's Feast, there is a lovely summary of the service they can provide. Through all the world, there goes one long cry from the heart of the artist. Give me the chance to do my best. A great gallery owner answers that cry and provides that chance by letting the artist focus on their work. Fellini said that the artist is merely the vehicle for his or her art, very rarely a spokesperson. The gallerist is vital to bridging the gap between creator and audience, explaining enough, but not so much that the mystery of the art's creation is destroyed. In 2020, galleries and gallerists with these qualities kept going. COVID gave us time to reflect. Art is not just decor, not just product. More than ever, in our noisy digital lives, it has meaning and value. It offers tangible consolation. So that's a great article from Julian. Well done, Julian. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And okay, yeah, well, that's it for now. As I say, as soon as the artists stop being shy, stop having other concerns that they can't do podcast episodes with me, we'll be back on track with more episodes soon. But yeah, until then, I hope you keep well. And feel free if you want to get in touch about any of that other stuff. But most of it you can get from Zach Bush. You get it a lot better than me anyway. Okay, we'll chat again soon, but we'll say goodbye for now.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.
Actually, I'd prefer a cup of tea. A cup of tea would be lovely. So, yeah, just a little reminder, mainly because every second or third person who becomes a patron has got in touch with me and said, you know what, I've been listening to your podcast for ages, and I didn't become a patron, not because I don't have the money, not because I don't think it's great, I just didn't get around to it. So this is a little friendly reminder that if you'd like to be a patron, you'd like to buy me a cup of tea, go to patreon.com/JohnDalton, gently does it, all one word, or follow the link in the show notes to become a patron. I would really appreciate it if you could do that, particularly if you've been meaning to and you just haven't got around to it. It would be great. It would mean a lot to me. All right. Thank you. Bye.
We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. Come on. Yeah, we are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. Come on.
Gonzo knows. My flow's equivalent to marinated mangoes dipped in soy sauce. Man, that means that I'm sick. Buy me a fruit spritzer with umbrella toothpick. It's time to celebrate. I just got my ring. Ned Plimpton, Team Zisu, you know how we do. You need to stand back. We flap gums and dance. Rap Rat Pack preparing for small amounts of cash. Count that slow, you little Jack Rolling dandies. We eat granulated jalapeno seed candy. Ronco, you see Han Solo and Tonto drop inventive skill like Ronco Pale Pronto. We soak in Calistoga volcanic ash, submerged in aqua surge, whirlpool bass, splish splash. We paddle on green seas with seaweed. The beach drinks green tea, me and some kiwi.
We are the Argyle Pimps, so buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps, so buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. We are the Argyle Pimps, so buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps, so buy us a drink. Buy us a drink. Come on, 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 buy us a drink. We're better than you.
Drink.
Come on.